Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
The title of the second talk, as Professor Lee mentioned, is Making Sense of Identity. In the last lecture, I discussed the problems that tend to arise from the illusion. We merely discover our identities and their demands, and that there is not much reasoning or choice involved in the identification of identities. The belief that identity-based understandings are matters of discovery, not of choice, has received considerable support in recent years, as I also discussed, not only from artisans of divisiveness and violence, but also from several schools of cultivated social thought, including those inclined towards communitarian ideas. Some championing has also come from theorists obsessed with classifying the people of the world into memberships of distinct and discrete civilizations, which is sometimes supplemented, not always, but sometimes by a further thesis of a clash of civilizations. The neglect, which is fairly common in the literature on identity, of the decisional perspective is, I have argued, epistemically befuddling and ethically inept, and can also be politically incendiary. The importance of the role of choice does not, however, entail any denial of the fact that we can discover many things about us ourselves which are important, and we do discover them in the full sense. In Rabindranath Tagore's wonderful Bengali novel, Gora, written a century ago, the problematic hero, also called Gora, ceaselessly champions old-fashioned Hindu customs and traditions, partly because of his populist anti-colonialism, and he is also a staunch religious and social conservative. However, Rabindranath Tagore places Gora in a difficult dilemma towards the end of the novel when his supposed mother at last confides to him that he was adopted as an infant by the Indian family when his Irish parents had been killed by the anti-British sepoys in 1857 during the famous Indian Mutiny. The name Gora in Bengali means fair, and presumably his unusual looks had received attention, but no clear diagnosis. Gora's militant conservatism is undermined at one stroke by Tagore, as Gora finds all doors of traditional Hindu temples closed to him, thanks to the conservative religious cause which he himself had been championing. We do discover many things about ourselves, even when they may not be as foundational as the one that Gora had to face. But to recognize this is not the same thing as making identity just a matter of discovery. Even when a person discovers something very important about oneself, there are still issues of choice to be faced. Gora, in this case, had to ask whether he should continue his championing of Hindu conservatism, though now from an inescapable distance, or redefine his priorities, reassess his ethnicity, and reconsider his identity. Gora chooses, ultimately, helped actually by his girlfriend, to see himself just as a human being, like millions of others in India, not delineated or defined by religion or caste or class or gender. There's no way of avoiding the choice of priorities or weights linked with different claims on our attention, including those that arise from our distinct and disparate identities. Decisions have to be made even when discoveries occur, and it makes a difference what choices we actually do make. While resisting the imposition of singular identities and arguing for the importance of reasoning and choice in identity-based thinking, it's also important to recognize the fact that choice-oriented understanding of identity has to address a number of quite difficult problems of its own. Even though the diversity of our identities can accommodate many different membership groups, we must resist the temptation to regard every group identification to be equally momentous, or for that matter, all of them to be potentially momentous in general. The world of identities can contain relatively trivial affiliations as well as very profound ones. Some identities may have a highly contingent and sometimes exceedingly fleeting existence. Maude Saul, the American comedian, is supposed to have responded to the intense tedium of watching a four-hour-long film directed by Otto Preminger called Exodus, dealing with Jewish migration out of Egypt led by Moses. He had responded to it by loudly voicing the demand on behalf of his fellow sufferers, "Otto, let my people go." The group of tormented film goers, whom Maude Saul could readily identify as quote-unquote my people, did have reason for fellow feeling then and there, but one can see the contrast between such an ephemeral identity with my people and the sense of belonging to the well-knit and seriously tyrannized community of people led by Moses, the original subject of that famous entreaty. However, even when we ignore the very temporary alliances, there will be a great many stable and durable identities related to, say, nationality, language, literature, ethnicity, politics, profession, etc. And the person will have to decide on their relative importance, which could vary depending on the context. Even a durable category to which one may belong need not necessarily be judged as a source of a weighty identity. There are two different but interrelated issues here. One, recognition of relevant identities, and two, weighing of the relative importance of the distinct demands associated with different identities in particular contexts. Classification can take many different forms. And not all categories that can be consistently generated would serve as a plausible basis for an important identity. Consider the set of people in the world who were born between 9 and 10 a.m. in the morning local time. This is a distinct and quite well-defined group. But it's hard to think that many people would get excited about sustaining the solidarity of such a group and the identity it potentially produces. Similarly, people who wear size 8 shoes are typically not linked with each other with a strong sense of identity on that shoe size ground. Rather important as that descriptive specificity is when it comes to buying shoes, or more importantly, in trying cheerfully to walk around in them. Classification is certainly cheap, but identity is not. More interestingly, whether a particular classification can plausibly generate a sense of identity or not must depend on the exact social circumstances. For example, if size 8 shoes became very difficult to obtain for some complicated technological or business or bureaucratic reason, to understand its plausibility, one would have to place oneself somewhere in Minsk or Pinsk at the high noon of the Soviet civilization, then the need for shoes of that size may indeed become a shared predicament and can give reason enough for solidarity and identity. For example, in setting up social clubs with liquor license to exchange information about the availability of size 8 shoes. Similarly, if it were to emerge that people born between 9 and 10 a.m. are, for reasons that we do not yet understand, particularly vulnerable to some specific ailment, Harvard Medical School might be marshaled to look into this, then again there is a shared quandary which can provide a reason for a sense of identity here. To consider a different variant of this example, if some authoritarian ruler wants to curb the freedom of people born in that particular hour, perhaps because of the ruler's supernatural belief on the perfidy of people born then, or because some Macbethian witches have told him that he will be killed by someone born between 9 and 10 a.m., then again a case for solidarity and identity based on that classificatory unity may indeed reasonably emerge. Reasoning is important for the diagnosis of a serious identity and for the relative weights that may be attached to the demands of the different identities we have. We do have the need and the opportunity to determine the weight we have, reason to place on our different associations and distinct identities. However, even when we are clear about how we want to see ourselves, we may still have difficulty in being able to persuade others to see us in just that way. A non-white person in apartheid-dominated South Africa could not insist that she be treated just as a human being, irrespective of her racial characteristics. She would have been typically placed in the category that the state and the dominant members of the society reserved for her. Mohandas Gandhi's attempt to insist on being seen as a London-trained barrister practicing law in South Africa rather than as a non-white person seeking a status that must be refused to him led to his being forcibly thrown off the train in which he was traveling. Our freedom to assert our personal identities can sometimes be extraordinarily limited in the eyes of others, no matter how we see ourselves. Adscription, however, is a complex activity with many different uses. It is important to acknowledge that attribution of descriptive characteristics to others that they themselves do not accept need not in itself be seen as nasty and monstrous. Indeed, it's a perfectly understandable fact of the world that we cannot always persuade others to see us in the way that we ourselves would like to be seen. You may be skeptical of my fond belief that I belong to the category of highly cultured persons. Never heard such nonsense, I overhear you saying. And in turn, I might think that you're a boorish observer. Won't recognize culture even if you were to fall flat on it, I remark. A description that you, in your turn, might strongly resist. It's not in itself odious that we can entertain quite different views about each other and classify people in disparate ways. Even though ascription can in many cases be a source of severe discrimination and can even feed violence, it's important to recognize that it is not in general a vicious phenomenon. Indeed, the weaponry of hateful characterization draws, and this is, I think, important, on perfectly ordinary features of human life. And this makes their savage and calamitous use all the more difficult to overcome and eradicate. Let me, however, begin with a couple of benign illustrations of third-person attributions. Many years ago, when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, one of my teachers, John Robinson, a great professor of economics, told me during a particularly argumentative tutorial, of which I have to confess we had many, and she told me at that moment of great frustration, let me tell you about the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Indian. The Japanese are much too polite. You Indians are much too rude. The Chinese are exactly right. I readily accepted this generalization with great rapidity. The alternative would have been to give further evidence of the Indian propensity towards rudeness. But I also recognized that no matter what I said or did, that imaging would not quickly change in my teacher's mind. Joan Robinson, by the way, was very fond of Indians. She thought that they were perfectly nice in an impertinent kind of way. Let me give another example of a very different kind of the difficulties that may arise in making people see us as we would like to be seen. It's in fact an old Italian anecdote. The story is from the 1920s when the Italian fascists were going around vigorously recruiting innocent Italians to build up their party. It concerns a political recruiter from the fascist party trying to persuade a rural socialist that he should join the fascist party instead. The rural socialist explained his resistance by saying, "I come from a socialist family. How can I join the fascist party? My father was a socialist. My grandfather was a socialist. I cannot possibly join the fascist party." "What kind of a stupid argument is that?" says the smart fascist recruiter, exasperated by the rural bloke's naivety. "What would you have done," he asks, "if your father had been a murderer and your grandfather had also been a murderer? What would you have done then?" "Ah, then," says the rustic dolt, "then of course I would have joined the fascist party." It's hard to change what others think of us, and sometimes it may even be difficult to know what they are making of us. And this, in general, is an entirely unpernicious social fact. And yet particular attributions can be potent instruments of debasement, ostracization, discrimination, and violence. "There used to be a me," Peter Sellers, the English actor, said in a famous interview, "but I had it surgically removed." That removal is challenging enough, but no less radical is the surgical implantation of a real me by others who are determined to mangle our barriers. And there are still others who want to recruit us as camp followers in their campaign to terrorize others by pressuring us in the direction of belligerent identities aimed against targeted victims. Organized switching of perceived self-identities has been responsible for many atrocities in the world. I referred in yesterday's lecture to my memory of the bloody riots in pre-partition India in the 1940s. The riots drew on newly devised and severely pressured identity contrasts, which transformed old friends into new enemies and allowed murderers to pose as putative comrades. Unreasoned acceptance of the alleged implications of one's identity has been the source of many genocides and other barbarities in the world. The denial of the role of choice in favor of the allegedly canonical role of discovery adds greatly to the flammability of the world in which we live. The art of incitement includes the imposition of singular identities both on the would-be protagonists who are instigated to do the nasty job and on those to whom such nastiness is dished out. The need to recognize the role of reasoning and choice in identity-based thinking is thus extremely important. Charged attributions can incorporate two distinct but interrelated distortions. One, misdescription of people belonging to a targeted category, and two, an insistence that the misdescribed characteristics are the only relevant features of the targeted person's identity. To describe someone as Jewish might be at one level no more than a diagnosis of a person's racial or ethnic ancestry, but for a Nazi, what went typically with that genealogical identification was the assignment of certain characteristics that the Nazis had specially selected along with vicious hatred for ascription to Jewish people. The background to violence not only includes distorted characterization, but also a single-minded insistence on seeing the persons thus identified only in those misdescribed terms, overlooking their other identities, including their basic humanity. William Shakespeare can perhaps be faulted for providing some comfort to descriptive bias in the way the story of the Merchant of Venice unfolds. But he certainly cannot be accused of overlooking the presence of plural identities, identities other than those of race and ethnicity. Indeed, it's hard to find a clearer declaration of the relevance of a shared human identity, no matter what one's racial identity is, than in Shylock's argument, I quote, "Hath not a Jew eyes? hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapon, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is." Unquote. The assertion of human commonality has been a part of resistance to degrading attributions in different cultures at different points of time. In the Indian epic Mahabharata, dating from around 2,000 years ago, Bharadwaj, an argumentative interlocutor, responds to the defense of the caste system by Bhrigu, a pillar of establishment, by asking, I quote from the Mahabharata, "We all seem to be affected by desire, anger, fear, sorrow, worry, hunger, and labor. How do we have caste differences then?" Unquote. The foundations of degradation not only include descriptive misrepresentation, but also the illusion of a singular identity that others must attribute to the person to be demean, overlooking all the common features that these two persons might share. As was discussed in the first lecture, the neglect of the plurality of identities plays an important part in the violence that we see in the contemporary world today. I discussed already about that in the context of the battle concerning terrorism and so on. If clashing civilization is a remarkably grand thesis about conflicts, there are lesser but also influential claims that relate contrasts of culture and identities to the conflicts and the profusion of atrocities that we see in different parts of the world today. Instead of one majestically momentous partition that splits the world population into contending civilization, as in Huntington's grand universe, the lesser variants of the approach see local populations as being split into clashing groups with divergent cultures and disparate histories, which are seen as inducing, in an almost natural way, enmity towards each other. Conflicts involving, say, Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda, Serbs and Albanians in former Yugoslavia, Hindus and Muslims in the Indian subcontinent, and so on, are then reinterpreted in lofty historical terms, seeing in them something that is more momentous and timeless than contemporary politics. Modern conflict, which calls for analysis in terms of contemporary events and machinations and all the detailed social factors that lie behind, are then interpreted simply as ancient feuds, which place today's players in preordained roles in an allegedly ancestral play. As a result, the civilizational or cultural approach in general to contemporary conflicts, in grander or lesser versions, serve as a general intellectual barrier to focusing adequately on prevailing politics and on thoroughly contemporary incitement to violence. Indeed, theories of civilizational clash has often provided apparently sophisticated foundations of crude and coarse popular belligerence. Cultivated theory can then bolster uncomplicated bigotry and can receive bemused cheer for that reason, if for nothing else. What then are the difficulties of explaining contemporary world events by invoking civilizational categories? And I come back to the grand one now. If its most basic weakness lies in the use of a particularly ambitious version of the illusion of singularity, a second problem is added to this by the crudeness with which the world civilizations are characterized, taking them to be more homogeneous and far more insular than what emerges from empirical analysis of their past and present. The civilizational approach has tended to suffer also from ignoring the diversities within each identified civilization and also from overlooking the extensive interrelation between distinct civilizations. I referred yesterday to Huntington's description of India as Hindu civilization. When one thinks about it, in order to characterize India as a Hindu civilization, you have to downplay the role of 140 million or more Muslims, more than, as I mentioned, any other country in the world, with the exception of Indonesia and very marginally Pakistan. Also, it would be, in fact, quite futile to try to have an understanding of the nature and range of Indian art, literature, music, films, or food without seeing the range of contributions coming from people of different religious backgrounds, Muslims as well as Hindus, and also Sikhs, Jains, Christians, and Parsis, and also atheists and agnostics who have flourished in India, is not often recognized, over several millennia, beginning from the 6th century BCE with the birth of Lokayat and Charvaka. And this is a fairly continuous trend to India. So in that respect, what we have at the moment, namely a Muslim president, a Sikh prime minister, and a Christian leader of the ruling party in a country with 82% Hindus, I think reflects a level of complexity that can hardly be captured by describing India as a part of Hindu civilization. The portrayal of India as Hindu civilization may be a crude mistake, but coarseness of one kind or another is present in the characterization of other civilizations as well, in this partitioned view of the history of the world. Consider what is called, quote-unquote, the Western civilization. I commented in the first lecture on the Arab contribution to Western science and mathematics. Indeed, while so-called Western science has certainly flourished well in the Western world over the recent centuries, even if occasionally in the company of resurgent creationism, it does draw on a world heritage. A large group of contributors from different non-Western societies, Chinese, Arab, Iranian, Indians, and others, influenced the science, mathematics, and philosophy that played a major part in European Renaissance and later in the Enlightenment. Similarly, civilizational classifiers, in line with the belief in the unique profundity of the singular line of division, tend to see tolerance as a special and enduring feature of Western civilization, extending way back into history. Indeed, this is seen as one of the important aspects of the clash of values that underpins the supposed clash of civilizations. Huntington insists, I quote, "The West was West long before it was modern." And he cites, among other allegedly special features of Western civilization, such as social pluralism, he adds, I quote, "a sense of individualism and a tradition of individual rights and liberties unique among civilized societies," unquote. This thesis is very hard to sustain. Tolerance and liberty are certainly among the important achievements of the modern West, leaving out a thing or two like Nazi Germany. But to see a unique line of historical division there, going back over the millennia, is remarkably fanciful. The championing of political liberty in its full contemporary form is not an old historical feature in any country or civilization in the world. Plato and Augustine were not less authoritarian in thinking than was Confucius. This is not to deny that there were champions of tolerance in classical European thought, but there are similar examples in other cultures as well. For example, the Indian Emperor Ashoka's dedicated championing of religious and other kinds of tolerance in the 3rd century BCE, arguing, for example, I quote, "the sects of other people all deserve reverence for one reason or another," unquote, is certainly among the earliest political defense of tolerance anywhere. When a later Indian emperor, Akbar, the great Mughal, was making similar pronouncements on religious tolerance in Agra, from the 1590s onwards, such as, I quote from Akbar, "no one should be interfered with on account of religion, and anyone is to be allowed to go over to a religion that pleases him," unquote, the Inquisitions were in full bloom in Europe. Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake in Campo di Fiori in Rome in 1600 for heresy, even as Akbar was lecturing on tolerance in Agra. Similarly, democracy is often seen as a quintessentially Western idea, which is alien to the non-Western world. Doubts are often expressed that the Western countries can, quote-unquote, impose democracy on Iraq or any other country. However, to pose the question in that form, invoking the idea of quote-unquote imposition, implies a proprietary belief that democracy belongs to the West, taking it to be a quintessentially Western idea which has originated and flourished only in the West. This is a thoroughly misleading way of understanding the history and the contemporary prospects of democracy. There can, of course, be no doubt at all that the modern concept of democracy and of public reasoning have been very deeply influenced by European and American experience over the last few centuries, including the influence of the European Enlightenment and the American War of Independence. But to extrapolate backwards that comparatively recent history to construct the quintessential and long-run dichotomy between the West and non-West would be extremely misleading. There is an alternative line of reasoning that makes democracy Western, which focuses specifically on ancient Greece. The belief in the allegedly Western nature of democracy is often linked to the practice of voting and elections, especially in Athens. But the jump from ancient Greece to the thesis of the allegedly Western or European nature of democracy is confusing and confounded for at least three distinct reasons, as I've tried to discuss in a recent presentation at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. First, there is the classificatory arbitrariness of defining civilizations in largely racial terms. In this way of looking at civilizational categories, no great difficulty is seen in considering the descendants of, say, Goths and Visigoths as proper inheritors of the Greek tradition. They're all Europeans, we are told. While there is great reluctance in taking note of the Greek intellectual links with other ancient civilizations to the east or south of Greece, despite the greater interest that the ancient Greeks themselves showed in talking to ancient Iranians, ancient Indians, or ancient Egyptians, rather than in chatting up the ancient Visigoths. The second issue concerns the follow-up of the early Greek experience. While Athens certainly was the pioneer in getting balloting started, there were many regional governments which went that way in the centuries to follow. There's nothing to indicate that the Greek experience in electoral governance had much immediate impact in the countries to the west of Greece and Rome, in, say, what is now France or Germany or Britain. In contrast, some of the contemporary cities in Asia, in Iran, in Bactria, in India, incorporated elements of democracy in municipal government in the centuries following the Athenian experience of democracy in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. For example, the Iranian city of Susa had elected governance for a long stretch of time with magistrates being put up for elections. Third, democracy is not just about ballots and votes, but also about public deliberation and reasoning. What, to use an old phrase, is often called government by discussion. While public reasoning did flourish in ancient Greece and flourished very well, It did so also in several other ancient civilizations, sometimes spectacularly so. For example, some of the earliest open general meetings aimed specifically at settling disputes between different points of view took place in India in the 6th century BCE onward in the so-called Buddhist councils, where adherents of different points of view got together to argue out their differences. The biggest of these councils, open general meeting, took place in 3rd century BCE under the patronage of Emperor Ashoka, to whom I referred earlier, who also went on to place across the country stone pillars with various statements on rules for public discussion when you have disagreement, something like an early version of Robert's Rules of Order. The tradition of public discussion can be found across the world. To choose another historical example, in the early 7th century Japan, the Constitution of 17 Articles, promulgated in 604 AD by Prince Shotoku, insisted, I quoted, "Decisions on important matters should not be made by one person alone. They should be discussed with many," unquote. This, as it happened, is 600 years earlier than the Magna Carta, signed in the 13th century. There's a long history of public discussion in different areas of the world. Even the all-conquering Alexander was treated to a good example of public criticism as he roamed around in northwest India around 325 BCE. When Alexander asked a group of giant philosophers why they were neglecting to pay any attention whatever to the great conqueror, he was obviously quite hurt by the neglect, he received the following forceful reply. So I quote from this giant philosopher, "King Alexander, every man can possess only so much of the earth's surface as this we are standing on. You are but human like the rest of us, save that you are always busy and up to no good, traveling so many miles from your home, a nuisance to yourself and to others. You will soon be dead, and then you will own just as much of the earth as will suffice to bury you," unquote. By the way, Alexander responded to this, as was his custom, with the same kind of tremendous admiration as he had shown towards Diogenes. But as Arian, the historian, notes, his conduct remained completely unchained by this admiration. Middle Eastern history and the history of Muslim people also include a great many accounts of public discussion and political participation through dialogues. In Muslim kingdoms centered around Cairo, Baghdad, and Istanbul, or in Iraq and India, for that matter Spain, there were many champions of public discussion. The extent of tolerance of diversity of views was often exceptional in comparison with Europe, varying from Muslim kingdom in Cordoba in 9th century Spain to Saladin's Egypt in 12th century. I might remind that Maimonides, when he found Europe far too intolerant, decided to go to the Arab world and seek refuge, and got it in Saladin's court, the same Saladin who had fought for Islam in the Crusades against, among others, Richard the Lionheart. In his autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom, Nelson Mandela describes how influenced he was as a young boy by seeing the democratic nature of the proceedings of the local meetings that were held in his African hometown. I quote from Mandela, "Everyone who wanted to speak did so. It was democracy in its purest form. There may have been a hierarchy of importance among the speakers, but everyone was heard, chief and subject, warrior and medicine man, shopkeeper and farmer, landowner and laborer," unquote. Mandela's quest for democracy and freedom did not emerge from any Western imposition. It began distinctly at his African home. So civilizational partitioning, I would argue, therefore, errs twice. One, in a grand way, relying exclusively on a single, singular classification, categorization, partition. And two, characterizing these civilizations with extreme crudeness and bringing out sharp contrasts which simply do not exist. I could have gone on to say, but I would have said also that, which I expunged from the talk in the last moment, but I'll add a little on that, that when one talks about global democracy, I think it's a great mistake to think of global democracy as something that requires a state government, global state government. It's really concerned with public discussion, so that every time you engage in the critique, public discussion occurs. Even from that point of view, to say, as was recently said in the context of the decision about whether juveniles could be put to capital punishment, that the world view is against that, to say that this has no relevance. That wasn't the main argument of those who took the view that it's unusual punishment, cruel and unusual punishment. But they did say that there was some interest in noting that the world view is in that direction. To ignore that is also basically to ignore global democracy, because global democracy consists of voice. And here again I must say that there's a long heritage across the world. One of the things, again, I'm not talking about here, which I do discuss quite a bit in the book, is the history of printing. It's not often recognized how much every early attempt at printing took place in Asia from actually Buddhist technologists in Korea, in China, in Japan. And in fact, I saw recently even a putative attempt in India and in the 6th and 7th century. The first book that was translated, that was printed, which is actually dated, the Diamond Sutra, is a translation of a Sanskrit Buddhist document into Chinese, was first translated in 401 AD by Kumarajiva. It was translated 6 or 7 times, and then finally printed in 868 AD. When it was printed, his dedication said, reverently printed with for the purpose of free public discussion, public distribution. So there was a concern with discussing issues in general, which I believe is a world heritage. And if you're talking about global democracy, that is really the arena that you're looking for, rather than a kind of two-chambered assembly for the world. I don't think that's at all the way to begin. I want to end by some statements about global justice. Identity choice can have implications not only for individual behavior, for national politics, for the categorization of people of the world into little boxes of incarcerated civilizations. It can also be relevant for our understanding of global justice. Recognizing the plurality of identities and the need for choice has the immediate implication that global justice must be distinguished from international justice, with which it is often confounded. To say global justice as international justice is to assume that the national identity of a person is the only, or at least the dominant, identity, just as sometimes, as I discussed yesterday, the world is seen as a federation of religion. This sees the world as a federation of nations and states. But people in different parts of the world interact with each other in many different ways, through commerce, through literature, through political agitations, through global NGOs, through the news media, through the internet, and so on. Their relations are not all mediated to governments or representatives of nations. And I think, even though I've learned so much of my philosophy from John Rawls, I think his characterization of global justice in his last substantive book, the Laws of People, the Law of People, goes, I believe, wrong in this respect. For example, a feminist activist in America who wants to help, say, to remedy some features of women's disadvantage in, say, Sudan, draws on a sense of identity that does not work through the sympathies of the big American nation for the predicament of another, the Sudanese nation. Her identity as a fellow woman may be more important here than her citizenship. Similarly, many NGOs, Médecins Sans Frontières, Oxfam, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and others, explicitly focus on affiliations and associations that cut across national boundaries, and the whole human rights literature draws on these shared identities, which does not have to be mediated by the states. Even commercial linkages and market relations can, we must recognize, establish human connections. Indeed, as early as in the 1770s, David Hume noted the importance of increased intercourse in expanding the reach of our sense of justice. I quote from Hume. Again, suppose that several distinct societies maintain a kind of intercourse for mutual convenience and advantage. The boundaries of justice still grow larger in proportion to the largeness of men's views and the force of their mutual connections. History, experience, reason sufficiently instruct us in this natural progress of human sentiments and in the gradual enlargement of our regards to justice in proportion as we become acquainted with the extensive utility of that virtue, unquote. Global justice cannot but embrace identities that go well beyond citizenship. This topic, which has always had strong ethical interest, has become especially prominent in recent years, partly as a result of protesting demonstrations from Seattle and Washington to Genoa and Prague. One of the first features to note about the recent demonstrations against globalization is the extent to which these protests were themselves globalized events, drawing on people from very many different countries and distinct regions in the world. They were not protests of local boys and girls. The concerns of the demonstrations have often been reflected in very roughly structured demands and crudely devised slogans, and many of them, I think, mistaken slogans. And the themes of these protests have been consistently more important than their thesis. In the present context, it is, however, particularly important to see that the sense of identity, which finds expression in these movements and also in many other expressions of global concern, grows well beyond national identities. The world is not just a collection of nations any more than it is a federation of religions or civilizations. It's a collection of persons with diverse diversities. International justice cannot exhaust the claims of global justice. Time for me to conclude today. To make sense of identity, we do have to take note of the plurality of identities that we all have and the recent decisions that such plurality demands. And we must also pay attention to the veracity, including historical accuracy and fairness, of the claims on which many of the grand generalizations about identities linked with culture and civilization, such as claims of Western civilization, are based. The insistence, if only implicitly, on a choiceless singularity of human identity diminishes us all. The alternative to the divisiveness of one preeminent categorization is not any unreal claim, and I do want to emphasize that we are all much the same. That we are not. Rather, the main hope of harmony in the contemporary world lies in the plurality of our identities, which cut across each other and works against sharp divisions around one single hardened line of impenetrable division. Our shared humanity gets savagely challenged when the confrontation is unified into one solitary system of categorization. This is much more divisive than the universe of plural and diverse differences that shape the world in which we actually live. The descriptive weakness of the illusion of choiceless singularity directly contributes thus to the political fragility of the precarious world in which we live. We certainly can do better than that. Seeing the richness of human identities can be an important first step in the direction of making the world less turbulent and a bit more secure. Thank you.
Abbas Kadhim. I'm a PhD student at the Department of Near Eastern Studies, working on Islamic studies. It's briefly a question. When your identity, or you are asked to prioritize your identities and you chose an identity as number four, having three others more important, that's how you like to be seen, to use your phraseology. Then you are seen by others, actually seen by your fourth identity as the only identity that is recognized by others. Here, can this identity, you think, be forced upon you? So can someone be coerced into an identity that erased all other identities that are voluntarily chosen as more important?
Yeah. I think that...
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Abbas. Two things to say on that. One is that I don't think you will get a kind of lexical priority over identities in that form for two reasons. First of all, the relative priorities of identities will depend very much on the context. As I mentioned yesterday, if you're going to a dinner, your identity as a vegetarian is more important than your identity as a poet. And similarly, if you're taking part in a political rally, your political view, the identity connected with that may be more important than other things. So they are not, as it were, stationary things. They are contextual, contingent, and circumstantial. That's the first thing to note. And secondly, they're not lexicographic in the sense of saying that they are prioritized in such a way that the slightest difference in the number one category will outweigh all the differences in all the other categories put together, which is the mathematical form of the lexicographic ordering. And that's the form in which you described it. And I would say it won't come like that. It's a question of weighing and balancing in the context of a particular argument as to how much priority you will give to this compared with another. None of them are so described in such a lexical form that none of the ones after, say, lexical is the dictionary thing, all words beginning with A dominate, come earlier than all words beginning with B, C, or D, no matter what the second letter is. It's not like that. The second point to note is that, yes, indeed, when somebody tries to impose an identity on me, I have then also a question to ask, namely, if I want to resist it, I may not want to resist it, but if I want to resist it, how should I resist it? But secondly, just because somebody is imposing an identity on me, it does not follow that I, in accepting or coming to terms with that identity, I forget all the other concerns and priorities that I might have. That is, for example, being Jewish in the context of Nazi Germany might have imposed on a person a very strong sense of solidarity and identity as a Jewish person. And that might have been something which the person trying to escape might have tried to deny, or trying to resist might try to assert. But when you're coming to a different context, Middle Eastern politics today, the force of that identity has to be rethought in the context in which you face it, namely how to think about Israel and Palestine, how to think about the rest of the world, and so on. So given that, the fact that some identity is being imposed on you is a momentous recognition which we must come to terms with. But that does not outweigh the need for us to decide, reason, and choose about how much importance we would attach to the particular identities that are being imposed on us in the particular context in which we find ourselves making a decision today. And it's that generality, that importance of decisional perspective, which I was trying to emphasize.
My name is Mujong Yang. I'm an exchange student from Germany.
So given you're saying identity is context-dependent, it seems very likely that, given in the political system, identity could play a role for political elites, for example, to mobilize kinds of political action. So we would kind of see identity in the political context as a valuable resource for these political elites. And in this context, then, isn't there kind of a grain of truth in Huntington's thesis of the clash of civilizations, that the humanistic ideal of the West, of including all humans, and I perfectly share this ideal, that this ideal raises potential for conflict, and without we would kind of separate the normative side, where we all certainly agree that it is desirable to have a unity of humanity, from the more descriptive side of how the political system would work.
I think if your point is that when a particular battle is engaged, then quite often the identities will be very sharply defined around that conflict, is certainly correct.
Yes.
I think to add to it, mm-hmm. is, and which is where it differs from the Huntington thesis, mm-hmm. is that these are contextually related to the political conflict that sets the stage for that assertion, as opposed to something which has been perennially present for hundreds or maybe thousands of years in the contrast between Western society, Asian society, African society, and so on, and or Hindu society, Muslim society, Buddhist society, and so on. So I think it's a very different vision. That's the first point to make. Secondly, even when there is a sharpness of that conflict, I think as reasoning human beings, and I believe the recognition that we do have a choice is a very important recognition, it's an empowering recognition, is to ask also not only the question, which side do I want to be on in this debate, as to whether on the, whatever it is, the conservative side or the reforming side or the liberal side or whichever, but also to ask the question, is this the particular way of classifying that I want to place myself in? Because I still have the freedom to consider the other things that make a difference to the world. So I think it's perfectly possible to recognize descriptively that the world has got in a very hardened way divided along certain lines. You can not only ask the question, which side am I on, but also the question, do I want this hardened line of division? Now, one of the things I talked about in yesterday, and you were here yesterday since you asked me a question yesterday, the way to categorize people in terms of, say, the Islamic world really overlooks such varieties of characteristics of the Muslim people, which are also present, which is not denied in any way. The whole idea of which is the true Muslim is such a befuddling question and has done such harm in trying to understand what's going on in the world and trying to also dissociate the Muslim people, as I discussed yesterday, from the historical background, science, mathematics, literature, and culture, just to focus on religion, that it has done an enormous amount of harm. So I think the descriptive point can be accepted without regarding that there is no further practical reason to be undertaken after that description has been accepted. So I think that's where, if there's a difference, that's where our difference may be. But thank you for the question.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.